Imagine being an American citizen and not being allowed to vote. That's the reality for at least 1 million incarcerated men and women around the country. And the 2020 Democratic candidates have been weighing in.
Part of the punishment when you were convicted of a crime and you're incarcerated is you lose certain rights. You lose your freedom. It does not make sense to have an exception for the right to vote.
Once someone has paid their debt to society, I think that means they get a right to vote. While they're still incarcerated, I think it's a different question.
I think the right to vote is inherent to our democracy. Yes, even for terrible people.
So some disagreement there among the candidates about who can vote from prison. But in at least 10 states, thousands of formerly incarcerated people who have already served their time are still unable to vote. Restoring voting rights to people after they've been released from prison is an issue that Democrats are more united behind.
I have been long an advocate of making sure that the formerly incarcerated are not denied a right to vote, which is the case in so many states in our country.
When you are out, one of the things that needs to be restored is your right to vote.
The debate over felon disenfranchisement is playing out across the country, where a patchwork map of state laws mean things look very different in Maine than they do in Iowa or in Wisconsin. And some states are more draconian than others. Florida legislators, for example, are debating whether felons should only vote after they've paid any outstanding financial obligations, and we'll have more on that in just a minute. First, back to the beginning, and why we take a criminal's right to vote away in the first place.
So this policy dates way back to a now antiquated view of both democracy and criminal justice. The idea being if you commit a crime, then you are an outlaw, you're outcast from society, you're subject to civil death, and so you aren't allowed to participate in our democratic institutions. I don't think that's the way we view criminal justice or democracy anymore.
Sean Morales Doyle is counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, specializing in voting rights.
But also specifically in a number of states, these policies exist in large part as a reaction to the 15th Amendment's mandate that Black people be allowed to vote. And states actually were coming up with ways of avoiding that and continuing to deny Black people the right to vote. And so they enacted laws that they knew would line up with a criminal justice system that disproportionately impacted people of color. And that continues to be the effect of many of these laws.
These laws, many of which are being fought today. I asked Sean to take us through the national landscape of felony disenfranchisement and why this topic is back front and center.
I think a couple of reasons. One of those is I think there's been some major change, perhaps the biggest change in decades on this issue in Florida just a couple months ago. And not only did Florida pass a constitutional amendment to restore voting rights to people who completed their sentence, but they did it with 64% of the vote. And so it showed that this is actually something that's politically popular across the political spectrum. But I do want to say also that while this is left to the states, the Constitution gives states primary jurisdiction to pass laws about elections, but actually there is room for the federal government to weigh in on this. And as part of the package that the House just passed, H.R. 1 earlier this session, was a piece called the Democracy Restoration Act, which has now been introduced by Senator Cardin as well, which would, on the Senate side as a standalone, which would restore voting rights to people who are no longer incarcerated in every state in the country for the purposes of federal elections as opposed to state elections, because Congress does have control over federal elections. And so I think there's a number of places where this has become central to the national conversation, both in terms of its political popularity, but also actually in the halls of Congress.
Let's talk about Florida. Mm-hmm. Specifically, you mentioned that this had passed, we actually covered it on the show, that this had passed by a large majority. And yet, This is still hitting a roadblock, despite the fact that Floridians want this bill to pass and they have passed it. What's the latest? Because now there are efforts to say, well, are we sure? Did we really want that? Tell us where things stand.
Yeah, so there are bills in both houses of the Florida legislature that have been introduced. Both of them would seriously diminish the impact of Amendment 4 by tinkering with the definition of completing all terms of your sentence. In Florida, the amendment says that if you've completed the terms of your sentence, then you have the right to vote. The House bill would make getting your rights back contingent on paying off all of the financial obligations that are heaped upon people in prison.
Pause right there. Mm-hmm. Why is it important that I pay anything in order to have the right to vote? Explain this connection to me.
Right. So in Florida especially, but in many states, when you are convicted of a felony, or really of any crime, there are a lot of financial consequences that come along with that. There's restitution, there's court fees, sometimes inappropriately that you have to pay for your own appointed lawyer. And so the idea is that's part of your sentence. That's what the Florida legislature is pushing. The fact is that these bills would require you to pay those things off even after they no longer are part of your sentence, when they've been converted to civil obligations, when they're just like any other debt that you might owe, when a court has determined this no longer is part of your criminal sentence. They want to still make that part of what you have to do in order to get your voting rights back. Of course, I don't think there is a good reason why what you can pay and how much you have paid should ever be linked to your right to vote. I think as a country, we decided we wanted to move past that when we passed a constitutional amendment to do away with poll taxes.
Okay, so moving on from Florida, there are actually two states where people can vote from prison, and that would be Maine and Vermont. Tell us about that experience. Why is that so rare?
In part, as I mentioned before, the practice of felony disenfranchisement predates the United States. It goes way, way back. And so a number of states had this written into their constitution from the very beginning. Maine and Vermont didn't. Maine and Vermont's constitutions were different in a number of ways, but one of them was that they never, ever had a policy of felony disenfranchisement. So while in the rest of the country, you are seeing states move generally progress towards providing more voting rights and having less felony disenfranchisement over the course of the last few decades, at the very least, Maine and Vermont just were never there in the first place.
How active do we know how active folks are who are incarcerated, who are interested in voting? Do they actually use their right to vote?
All of the research about people voting who are formerly incarcerated or who have been convicted of felonies suggests that both registration and turnout rates are very, very low among that population.
Do we know why that is?
I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons why that is. One of those reasons, in a place like New York, say, where we have a bizarre policy where you can vote when you're on probation and not when you're on parole, although now the governor is restoring voting rights to people on parole through his pardon, is that people just don't know what the rule is. And so people are very confused. And even if you live in someone like Maine and Vermont, if you've heard about the fact that people with a record can't vote, then you think you can't vote and you're worried that you're going to do something wrong if you vote. And so we have a problem of de facto disenfranchisement. People just don't understand. But I also think that you're talking about a group of people who have been thoroughly disenchanted with the way the system works, who have been pushed to the outskirts and the margins of society in a million different ways, and who, quite frankly, often have way more on their minds and on their plates than getting out to the polls. They need to be worrying about shelter and employment and food. So I think there are a lot of things at play, but I think that there are ripple effects, that there are entire communities who have a message sent to them by these policies that their voices don't matter, that there's not a good reason to participate. And so I think in addition to the confusion, we see these policies extending to lower turnout in the community at large.
And yet there's a study that shows that voting, in fact, of restoring these votes has been proven to reduce recidivism rates among formerly incarcerated individuals. Is that right?
I think that there are a number of studies that have suggested that. There are also a lot of voices in the law enforcement and community supervision community who are very much in favor of restoring voting rights. Just recently in New York, the DA in Nassau County wrote a letter. One of the DAs in the city wrote a letter to the legislature encouraging them to restore voting rights to people on parole. The American Probation and Parole Association has come out in favor of this. I think people who are actively involved in trying to engage people in healthy reintegration into their communities are almost universally in favor of restoring voting rights, because it is the most pro-social behavior people can engage in, and it is a way for people to have a real stake in the community that they're returning to. And I think that is something we should all keep in mind, that it is actually in all of our interests to make sure that the people who are welcomed back to our communities feel like they have a stake and an interest in our democracy.
We talked about Maine, we talked about Vermont, we talked about Florida. What about, and I don't need you to give me the 50-state
sure.
list, but where, you know, is this indicative of a larger push to end this type of disenfranchisement beyond Florida, particularly for felons?
Yes. There has been, as I said, a trend over the last couple of decades of movement of progress on this issue across the country. That we went from, in the 60s, a situation where there were many states that permanently disenfranchised everybody who had been convicted of a felony. That is now only the case after Amendment 4 in Florida, in Iowa and Kentucky. There's 16 states and D.C. where everyone living in the community can vote. That includes Maine and Vermont, where you never lose your right. And we've seen progress there in New York with Governor Cuomo's action last year, in Louisiana legislation passed last year, which restored voting rights to a lot of people on probation and parole. We've seen bills introduced in more than a dozen states, perhaps more than 20 states this year, and progress made in a number of states towards passage. I think that we are seeing a national trend, and I think Florida sort of was the most obvious and impactful example of that in terms of the number of people impacted, but it also served as a reminder to a lot of other states that this is actually something that is politically viable and that people are really interested in, that voters are enthusiastic about.
Florida is also fighting it. And Florida is a key state in every election. We know, as we've mentioned, there's a big one coming up in 2020. Is that factoring into the equation so far in terms of whether states, given the power that that state could have in a general election, whether that state may or may not try to move these forward?
Yes, I do think that there are people in Florida and elsewhere who are motivated by party politics when deciding who should have the right to vote and who should not. I think we should all be able to agree that who will win an election should not be what determines who we give the right to vote to, that we should not be making our decisions about who has the right to vote based on what impact we think that is going to have on the outcome of any given election. But yes, I do think that's something people take into account, and I think it's a shame. I mean— Amendment 4 received more than 1 million votes than any candidate in Florida did. The politicians in Florida should be getting the message loud and clear from their constituents that no matter where they are on this party spectrum, they don't think it's proper or appropriate to be denying all these people the right to vote. And I hope that that is the message that will drive this conversation moving forward rather than some, you know, consideration of party politics and who's going to win the next presidential election.
We also have another thing happening in 2020, which is a little thing called the census, which is having its own political brouhaha, if you will. But within this census, prisoners are counted, or incarcerated individuals are counted. But how are they counted?
So there's sort of two questions there. There's the question of how the census counts them, and then there's the question of how the states take them into account when redistricting. My understanding is that the census counts them in the place where they are incarcerated. For most purposes, that's not going to have a huge impact. Most people are incarcerated in the state where they live, right? It's only federal prisoners who are going to end up incarcerated somewhere else, and that's a small percentage. But for redistricting purposes, what's important is how states take those census results and use them in deciding where to draw lines for election districts. And in many, many states, they count people in the place where they are incarcerated, which usually, like in New York, most people are not incarcerated in New York City. If they're from New York City, they end up getting incarcerated upstate somewhere. So that's going to skew where it looks like people live for purposes of determining the political power of various parts of the state. A few states have passed legislation to end what people often refer to as prison gerrymandering. And in fact, yesterday, the state of Washington, the governor signed a bill to do just that and to start counting people in the place where they came from, at their last address before incarceration, so that political power is distributed in accordance with where people live and not where they are temporarily incarcerated.
And just wrapping up here, how do issues around felon voting rights tend to poll with voters, regardless of party affiliation? Is Florida sort of a beacon in this space? Or was that a bipartisan decision, or was that leaning towards one side or the other?
Anything that gets more than 50% of the vote in Florida is a bipartisan result. Polling both before Amendment 4 and since Amendment 4 continues to show that there is support for this across party lines. There was just a poll not too long ago in Kentucky, which is one of the remaining states with permanent disenfranchisement, that showed that yet again. I mean, I think it depends on exactly the precise contours of the policy that you're polling on and what you're asking people to weigh in on. But generally, the concept of restoring voting rights to people who are living in their community, I think, is something that people in both the Democratic and Republican and non-party affiliated people are in favor of. And polling has shown that time and time again. And I think Florida just proved that in a way that people really can believe.
Sean Morales Doyle is counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and he specializes in voting rights. Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you.